I reach in there and lift out a typewritten manuscript, 400 or 500 pages. I leap through. It's a novel about Vietnam. I look at Babs. He gives me a smile of good fellowship with his day-glow mask glowing and crinkling up. It's all in there, I say. Then I guess it takes a while to get it. Yeah, right, says Babs, breaking into a laugh as if I just said the funniest thing in the world. Yeah, right, with the mask glowing and bouncing around on his face. I lower the novel back into the box, and for days I would notice Babs's novel about Vietnam lying out there on the floor, out in the middle of everything, as if waiting for a twister to whip it up and scatter it over San Francisco County. And Babs would be somewhere around saying to some other bemused soul, Yeah, right. The merry pranksters were all rapidly assembling, waiting for Kesey. George Walker arrives. Walker has on no costume. He is just like some very clean-cut blonde college kid wearing a T-shirt and corduroy pants, smiling and outgoing, just a good West Coast golden boy, except for a few random notes like the Lotus racing car he has outside, painted with orange day-glow so that it lights up at dusk, skidding around the corners of the California suburbs in four-wheel drifts. And Paul Foster. Foster, I am told, is some kind of mad genius, a genius at computers, with all sorts of firms with names like Techniflex, Digitron, Solartex, Automaton, trying to hunt him down to lay money on him to do this or that for them. Whether he is a genius or not, I couldn't say. He certainly looks mad enough. He is hunched over in a corner, in a theater seat, an emaciated figure but with a vast accumulation of clothes. It looks like he has on about 8 pairs of clown's pants, one on top of the other, each one filthier than the next one, all black, sooty, torn, mungy, and fungus. His head is practically shaven, and he is so thin that all the flesh seems to be gone off his head. And when he contracts his jaw muscles, it is as if some very clever anatomical diagram has been set in motion with little facial muscles, striations, sheaths, ligaments, tissues, nodules, integuments that nobody ever suspected before, bunching up, popping out, springing into definition in a complex chain reaction. And he contracts his jaw muscles all the time, concentrating, with his head down and his eyes burning, concentrating on a drawing he is doing on a pad of paper, an extremely small but crucial drawing by the looks of his concentration. Black Mariah sits on a folding chair and smiles ineffably but says nothing. One of the flag people, a thin guy, tells me about Mexicans strung out on huaraches. Doris DeLay tells me, "They're off on their own freak," Hassler continues, "and it may not look like much, but they're starting to transcend the bullshit. There's this old trinity, power, position, authority. And why should they worship these old gods and these old forms of authority?" Fuck God. Eh? Fuck God. This is a voice behind a blanket curtain to one side. Somebody is back there rapping off what Hassler just said. Fuck God. Up with the devil. It is a very sleepy, dreamy voice, however. The curtain pulls back, and standing there is a wiry little guy who looks like a pirate. Behind him, back in there behind the curtain, all sorts of wires, instruments, panels, speakers are all piled up, a glistening heap of electronic equipment, and the tape is back there going, "In the Nowhere Mine." The guy looks like a pirate, as I said, with long black hair combed back Tarzan style, and a mustache, and a gold ring through his left earlobe. He stares out sleepily. In fact, he is a Hell's Angel. His name is Freewheeling Frank. He has on the Hell's Angels colors, meaning a jacket with insignia, a jacket with the sleeves cut off and the skull with the helmet on it and the wings and a lot of other arcane symbols. "Fuck God," says Freewheeling Frank. "Fuck all forms of... And the words trail off in a kind of dreamy way, although his lips are still moving and he kind of puts his head down and trudges off into the gloom toward the bus, with his hands flicking out, first this side, then the other, like Cassidy. And he is off on his trip, like Cassidy, and all right, a Hell's Angel. And the Hassler brushes his teeth after every meal in the middle of a Shell Station tin can economy. Just then, Kesey arrives. Chapter 3. The Electric Suit. Through the sheet of sunlight at the doorway and down the incline into the crazy gloom comes a panel truck, and in the front seat is Keezy. The chief, out on bail. I half expect the whole random carnival to well up into a fluorescent yahoo of incalculably insane proportions. In fact, everybody is quiet. It is all cool. Keezy gets out of the truck with his eyes down. He's wearing a sport shirt, an old pair of pants, and some western boots. He seems to see me for an instant, but there is no hello, not a glimmer of recognition. This annoys me, but then I see that he doesn't say hello to anybody. Nobody says anything. They don't all rush up or anything. It's as if Keezy is back, and what is there to say about it? Then Mountain Girl booms out, "How was jail, Keezy?" Keezy just shrugs. "Where's my shirt?" he says. Mountain Girl fishes around in the debris over beside a bunch of theater seats and gets the shirt, a brown buckskin shirt with an open neck and red leather lacings. Keezy takes off the shirt he has on. He has huge latissimi dorsi muscles making his upper back fan out like manta ray wings. Then he puts on the buckskin shirt and turns around. Instead of saying anything, however, he cocks his head to one side and walks across the garage to the mass of wires, speakers, and microphones over there and makes some minute adjustment. The nowhere mine. As if now everything is under control and the fine-tuning begins. From out of the recesses of the garage, I didn't even know they were there, here comes a woman and three children. Keezy's wife, Faye, their daughter Shannon, who is six, and two boys, Zane, 5, and Jed, 3. Faye has long, sorrel brown hair and is one of the prettiest, most beatific-looking women I ever saw. She looks radiant, saintly. Keezy goes over to her and picks up each of the kids, and then Mountain Girl brings over her baby, Sunshine, and he picks up Sunshine a moment. All right. Then Keezy loosens up and smiles, as if he just thought of something. It is as if he just heard Mountain Girl's question about how was jail. "The only thing I was worried about was this tooth," he says. He pops a dental plate out of the roof of his mouth and pushes a false front tooth out of his mouth with his tongue. "I had the awfulest feeling," he says. "I was going to be in court or talking to reporters or something, and this thing was going to fall down like this, and I was going to start gumming my words." He gums the words, "Start gumming my words," to illustrate. 3 weeks later, he was to replace it with a tooth with an orange star and green stripes on it, an enameled dens incisus lateral bearing a prankster flag. One day at a gas station, the manager, a white guy, gets interested in the tooth and calls over his helper, a colored guy, and says, "Hey, Charlie, come over here and show this fella your tooth." So Charlie grins and bares his upper teeth, revealing a gold tooth with a heart cut out in the gold so that a white enamel heart shows through. Keezy grins back and then bares his tooth. The colored guy stares a moment and doesn't say anything. He doesn't even smile. He just turns away. A little while later, down the road, Keezy says very seriously, very sorrowfully, "That was wrong of me. I shouldn't have done that." "Done what?" "I out-niggered him," says Keezy. Out-niggered him. Keezy has kept these countryisms like the awfulest feeling all through college, graduate school, days of literary celebration. "How did it happen?" says freewheeling Frank, meaning the tooth. "He got in a fight with a Hell's Angel," says Mountain Girl. "What?" Freewheeling Frank is truly startled. "Yeah," says Mountain Girl, "the bastard hit him with a chain." "What?" says Frank. "Where? What was his name?" Keezy gives Mountain Girl a look. "No," she says. "What was his name?" Frank says. "What did he look like?" "Mountain Girl is shucking you," Keezy says. "I was in a wreck." Mountain Girl looks repentant. Angel's Jewel's no joke with Frank. Keezy breaks up the vibrations. He sits down in one of the old theater seats. He is just talking in a soft, conversational tone with his head down, just like he is having a conversation with Mountain Girl or somebody. "It's funny," he says. "There are guys in jail who have been in jail so much that's their whole thing. They're jail freaks. They've picked up the whole jail language." Everybody starts gathering around, sitting in the old theater seats or on the floor. The misto steam begins rising. Only it isn't their language, it's the guards. the cops, the DAs, the judges. It's all numbers. One of them says, what happened to so-and-so? And the other one says, oh, he's over in 34, which is a cell block. They got him on a 211. They have numbers for different things, just like you hear on a police radio. They got him on a 211, but he can cop to a 213 and get 3 to 5, 1.5 with good behavior. The cops like that. It makes them feel better if you play their game. They'll chase some guy and run him down and pull guns on him, and they're ready to blow his head off if he moves a muscle. But then as soon as they have him in jail, one of them will come around and ask him how his wife is, and he's supposed to say she's okay, thanks, and ask him about his kids. Like, now that we've played the cops and robbers part of the game, you can go ahead and like me. And a lot of them in there go along with that because that's all they know. When you're running, you're playing their game, too. I was up in Haight-Ashbury, and I heard something hit the sidewalk behind me, and it was a kid had fallen out the window. A lot of people rushed up, and a woman was there crying and trying to pick him up. And I knew what I should do is go up and tell her not to move him, but I didn't. I was afraid I was going to be recognized. And then up the street I saw a cop writing out parking tickets, and I was going to go up and tell him to call an ambulance. But I didn't. I just kept going. And that night I was listening to the news on television, and they told about a child who fell out of a window and died in the hospital. And that's what the cops and robbers game does to you. Only it is me thinking it. Figuring out parables, I look around at the faces, and they are all watching Kesey, and I have not the slightest doubt, thinking, and that's what the cops and robbers game does to you. Despite the skepticism I brought here, I am suddenly experiencing their feeling. I am sure of it. I feel like I am in on something the outside world, the world I came from, could not possibly comprehend. And it is a metaphor, the whole scene, ancient and vast. Vaster than... Two guys come in out of the daylight on Harriet Street, heads by the looks of them, and walk up to Kesey. One of them is young, with a sweatshirt on, and Indian beads with an amulet hanging from the beads. A routine acid head look, in other words. The other one, the older one, is curiously neat, however. He has long black hair, but neat, and a slightly twirly mustache like a cavalier, but neat, and a wildly flowered shirt, but neat and well-tailored and expensive, and a black leather jacket, only not a motorcycle jacket, but tailored more like a coat, and a pair of English boots that must have set him back $25 or $30. At first he looks like something out of Lake North Beach, the boho with a $1,000 wardrobe, but he has a completely sincere look. He has a thin face with sharp features and a couple of eyes burning with truth oil. He says his name is Gary Goldhill and he wants to interview Kesey for the Haight-Ashbury newspaper, The Oracle. And when could he do that? But right away it is obvious that he has something to get off his chest that can't wait. The thing is, Ken, he has an English accent, but it is a middle-class accent, a pleasant sort of Midlands accent. The thing is, Ken, a lot of people are very concerned about what you've said, or what the newspapers say you've said about graduating from acid. A lot of people look up to you, Ken. You're one of the heroes of the psychedelic movement. He has a kind of Midlands England way of breaking up long words into syllables. Psychedelic movement. And they want to know what you mean. A very beautiful thing is happening in Haight-Ashbury, Ken. A lot of people are opening the doors in their minds for the first time, but people like you have to help them. There are only two directions we can go, Ken. We can isolate ourselves in a monastery, or we can organize a religion along the lines of the League for Spiritual Discovery. The League for Spiritual Discovery. And have acid and grass legalized as sacraments, so everyone won't have to spend every day in fear waiting for the knock on the door. It can be worse to take it as a sacrament, Kesey says. You've been away for almost a year, Ken, Goldhill says. You may not know what's been happening in Haight-Ashbury. It's growing, Ken, and thousands of people have found something very beautiful. And they're very open and loving, but the fear and the paranoia, Ken, the waiting for the knock on the door, it's causing some terrible things, Ken. It's responsible for a lot of bad trips. People are having bad trips, Ken, because they take acid and suddenly they feel that any moment there may be a knock on the door. We've got to band together. You've got to help us, Ken, and not work against us. Kesey looks up, away from Goldhill, out across the gloom of the garage. Then he speaks in a soft, far-off voice, with his eyes in the distance. If you don't realize I've been helping you with every fiber in my body, if you don't realize that everything I've done, everything I've gone through, it is rising and rising. I know, Ken, but the repression. We're in a period now like St. Paul and the early Christians, Kesey says. St. Paul said if they shit on you in one city, move to another city. And if they shit on you in that city, move on to another city. I know, Ken, but you're telling people to stop taking acid, and they're not going to stop. They've opened up doors in their minds they never knew existed, and it's a very beautiful thing. And then they read in the papers that somebody they've looked up to is suddenly telling them to stop. There's a lot of things I can't tell the newspapers, says Kesey. His eyes are still focused long-range, away from Gold Hill. One night in Mexico, in Manzanillo, I took some acid and I threw the I Ching. And the I Ching, the great thing about the I Ching is it never sends you valentines, it slaps you in the face when you need it. And it said we had reached the end of something. We weren't going anywhere any longer, it was time for a new direction. And I went outside and there was an electrical storm, and there was lightning everywhere, and I pointed to the sky and lightning flashed, and all of a sudden I had a second skin of lightning, electricity. Like a suit of electricity. And I knew it was in us to be superheroes, and that we could become superheroes or nothing. He lowers his eyes. I couldn't tell this to the newspapers. How could I? I wouldn't be put back in jail. I'd be put in Pescadero. Rising, rising. But most people aren't ready for that, Ken, Goldhill says. They're just beginning to open the doors in their minds. But once you've been through that door, you can't just keep going through it over and over again. And somebody's got to help them through that door. Don't say stop plunging into the forest, Kesey says. Don't say stop being a pioneer and come back here and help these people through the door. If Leary wants to do that, that's good. It's a good thing and somebody should do it. But somebody has to be the pioneer and leave the marks for others to follow. Kesey looks up again, way out into the gloom. You've got to have some faith in what we're trying to do. It's easy to have faith as long as it goes along with what you already know. But you've got to have faith in us all the way. Somebody like Gleason. Gleason was with us this far. Kesey spreads his thumb and forefinger about 2 inches apart. He was with us as long as our fantasy coincided with his. But as soon as we went on further, he didn't understand it, so he was against us. He had no faith. No faith. Bay fog turned steam, hissing in the old cranium. Faith. Further. And it is an exceedingly strange feeling to be sitting here in the day glow on poor obsessed Harriet Street and realize suddenly that in this improbable, crazy X-Pi factory, warehouse, garage, I am in the midst of Tsongi Shapa and the Sangha Communion. Mani and the Wan persecuted at the gate. Zoroaster. Maijoi Maunga and the five faithful before Vishtapu. Mohammed and Abu Bakr and the disciples amid the Pharisaical Quraysh of Mecca. Gautama and the brethren in the wilderness, leaving the blood and kin families of their pasts for the one true family of the Sangha inner circle. In short, true mystic brotherhood. Only in poor old Formica polyethylene 1960s America, without a grain of desert sand or a shred of palm leaf or a morsel of manna wilderness breadfruit overhead, picking up vibrations from Ampex tapes and a juggled Williams Lockhead sledgehammer, hooking down mathematical lab drugs, LSD-25, IT-290, DMT, instead of Soma water, heading out in American flag airport coveralls and an international harvester bus, yet for real, amid the marshmallow shiny black shoe masses. Chapter 4. What do you think of my Buddha? The current fantasy. By now, late evening, most of the pranksters have cleared out of the warehouse, off to take a shower at the apartment of Gut, an ex-Hell's Angel who has a psychedelic shop called Joint Ventures, off to here, off to there. Just Kesey and a couple of others left in the warehouse. Kesey stands in the gloom of the control central, over to the side amid the tapes, and cans of movie film marked with adhesive strips, and notebooks, and microphones, and wires, and coils, speakers, amplifiers. The prankster archives. And a tape drones on in a weird voice full of Ouija whammy. The blissful counterstroke. A considerable new message. A considerable new message. The current fantasy. Fantasy is a word Kesey has taken to using more and more for all sorts of plans, ventures, worldviews, ambitions. It is a good word. It is ironic, and it isn't. It refers to everything from getting hold of a pickup truck, that's our fantasy for this weekend, to some scary stuff out on the raggedy edge, like the current fantasy, which is somehow to be told at the acid test graduation. But how to tell it? Kesey rummages through the film cans and assorted archives. It has never been possible, has it truly, just to come out and announce the current fantasy, not even in days gone by when it seemed so simple. Now, you take Goldhill, who was just in here with the truth in his eyes. He will come closer than most. Kesey could see it. Goldhill was open, and into the pudding. He had his own fantasy, the League for Spiritual Discovery. And yet he is the rare kind who might even be willing to move with their fantasy, his and the pranksters. It takes a rare kind. Because always comes the moment when it's time to take the prankster circus further on toward Edge City. And always at that point some good souls are startled. Hey, wait! Like Ralph Gleason with his column in the Chronicle and his own clump of hipness. Gleason is one of those people. Kesey can remember them all, people who thought he was great so long as his fantasy coincided with theirs. But every time he pushed on further, and he always pushed on further, they became confused and resentful. The tape winds on. The blissful counterstroke. Through workhorse and intercourse. The blood that was available to him in intercourse made us believe he was in the applesauce for 20 years. Only lucky dogs and merry pranksters can understand this supersonic warble. Most likely. The blissful counterstroke. The current fantasy. Even back on Perry Lane, where everyone was young and intellectual and analytical, and the sky supposedly was the limit, there was no way he could just come right out and say, "Come in a little closer, friends." They had their own fantasy for him. He was a diamond in the rough. Well, that was all right, being a diamond in the rough. He had gone to Stanford University in 1958 on a creative writing fellowship, and they had taken him in on Perry Lane because he was such a swell diamond in the rough. Perry Lane was Stanford's bohemian quarter. As bohemias go, Perry Lane was Arcadia just off the Stanford golf course. It was a cluster of two-room cottages with weathery wood shingles in an oak forest, only not just amid trees and greenery, but amid vines, honeysuckle tendrils, all buds and shoots and swooping tendrils and twitterings like the best of Arthur Rackham and Honey Bear. Not only that, it had true cultural cachet. Thorstein Veblen had lived there. So had two Nobel Prize winners everybody knew about, though the names escaped them. The cottages rented for just $60 a month. Getting into Perry Lane was like getting into a club. Everybody who lived there had known somebody else who lived there, or they would never have gotten in. And naturally, they got to know each other very closely, too, and there was always something of an atmosphere of communal living. Nobody's door was ever shut on Perry Lane except when they were pissed off. It was sweet. Perry Lane was a typical 1950s bohemia. Everybody sat around, shaking their heads over America's tail fin, housing development, civilization, and Christ in Europe, so what if the plumbing didn't work? They had mastered the art of living. Occasionally, somebody would suggest an orgy or a 3-day wine binge, but the model was always that old Zorba the Greek romanticism of sandals and simplicity and back to first principles. Periodically, they would take pilgrimages 40 miles north to North Beach to see how it was actually done. The main figures on Perry Lane were two novelists, Robin White, who had just written the Harper Prize novel Elephant Hill, and Gwen Davis, a kind of West Coast Don Powell. In any case, all the established Perry Laners could see Kesey coming a mile away. He had Jack London, Martin Eden, Searching Hick, the Hick with intellectual yearnings written all over him. He was from Oregon. Who the hell was ever from Oregon? And he had an Oregon country drawl and too many muscles and calluses on his hands, and his brow furrowed when he was thinking hard, and it was perfect. White took Kesey under his wing and got him and his wife Faye a cottage on Perry Lane. The Perry Lane set liked the idea at once. He could always be counted on to do perfect things. Like the time they were all having dinner. There was a lot of communal dining, and some visitor was going on about the ineffable delicacy of James Baldwin's work, and Kesey keeps eating, but also trying to edge a word in, saying, "Well, bub, I don't know. I can't exactly go along with you there." And the fellow puts down his knife and fork very carefully and turns to the others and says, "I'll be delighted to listen to whatever Mr. Kesey has to say, as soon as he learns to eat from a plate without holding down his meat with his thumb." Perfect. He had been voted most likely to succeed at his high school in Springfield, Oregon, and had graduated from the University of Oregon, where he was all involved in sports and fraternities, the All-American Boy Bit. He had been a star wrestler in the 174-pound class and a star actor in college plays. He had even gone to Los Angeles after he finished college and knocked around Hollywood for a while with the idea of becoming a movie star. But the urge to write, to create, had burst up through all this thick, lumpy, all-American crap somehow, like an unaccountable purslane blossom. And he had started writing, even completing a novel about college athletics, End of Autumn. It had never been published, and probably never would be, but he had the longing to do this thing. And his background, it was great, too. Somehow the Perry Lane set got the idea that his family were Okies coming out of the Dust Bowl during the Depression, and then up to Oregon, wild, sodden Oregon, where they had fought the land and shot bears, and the rivers were swift, and the salmon leaped silver in the spring, big, two-hearted rivers. His wife, Faye, she was from the same kind of background, only she came from Idaho, and they had been high school sweethearts in Springfield, Oregon, and had run off and gotten married when they were both freshmen in college. They once made a bet as to which of them had been born in the most low-rent, bottom-dog shack, his old place in La Junta, or hers in Idaho. He was dead sure there was no beating La Junta for run down until they got to Idaho, and she sure as hell did win that one. Faye was even more soft-spoken than Kesey. She hardly spoke at all. She was pretty and extremely sweet, practically a Madonna of the hill country. And their cottage on Perry Lane, well, everybody else's cottage was run down in a careful bohemian way, simplicity, Japanese paper lamp globes and monk's cloth and blonde straw rugs and Swedish stainless steel knives and forks and cornflowers sticking out of a hand-thrown pot. But theirs was just plain low rent. There was always something like a broken washing machine rusting on the back porch, and pigweed, bladder pods, skoke and scurf peas growing ragged out back. Somehow it was perfect to have him and Fay on hand to learn as the Perry Lane sophisticates talked about life and the arts. Beautiful. The current fantasy. But how to tell them about such arcane little matters as Captain Marvel and the Flash and the life and the very super kids, a considerable new message, the blissful counterstroke, when they had such a nice clear picture of him as the horny-nailed son of the western sod, fresh from Springfield, Oregon. It was true that his father, Fred Kesey, had started him and his younger brother Joe, known as Chuck, shooting and fishing and swimming as early as they could in any way manage it, also boxing, running, wrestling, plunging down the rapids of the Willamette and the Mackenzie Rivers, on inner tube rafts, with a lot of rocks and water and certain death foaming down below. But it was not so they could tame animals, forests, rivers, wild upturned, convulsed Oregon. It was more to condition them to do more of what his father had already done a pretty good job of, claim whatever he can rightly get by being man enough to take it, and not on the frontier either. Kesey Sr. had been part of the 1940s migration from the Southwest, not of Okies, but of Protestant entrepreneurs who looked to the West Coast as a land of business opportunity. He started out in the Willamette Valley with next to nothing and founded a marketing cooperative for dairy farmers, the Eugene Farmers Cooperative, and built it into the biggest dairy operation in the area, retailing under the name of Dairy Gold. He was one of the big post-war success stories in the valley, and ended up not in an old homestead with wood sidings and lightning rods, but in a modern home in the suburbs, low-slung and pastel, on a street called Deborah Lane. The incredible post-war American electro-pastel surge into the suburbs. It was sweeping the valley with superhighways, dreamboat cars, shopping centers, soaring 30-foot Federal Sign and Signal Company electric super-sculptures, 8 new plexiglass display features, a surge of freedom and mobility, of cars and the money to pay for them and the time to enjoy them, and a home where you can laze in a rich pool of pale wall-to-wall or roar through the technological wonder world in motor launches and, in the case of men like his father, private planes. The things he would somehow suddenly remember about the old hometown, over here, for example, is the old white clapboard house they used to live in. And behind it, back a ways, is the radio tower of station KORE, with a red light blinking on top. And at night he used to get down on his knees to say his prayers, and there would be the sky and the light blinking. And he always kind of thought he was praying to that red light. And the old highway used to take a bend right about here, and it seemed like there was always somebody driving through about 3 or 4 in the morning, half asleep. And they would see the lights over there in town where it was getting built up, and they'd think the road headed straight for the lights, and they'd run off the bend, and Kesey and his dad would go out to see if they could help the guy draggle himself out of the muck, chasing street lights, praying to the red beacon light of KORE. And a little run-in at Greg's Drive-In, as it used to be called. It is now Specs, at Franklin Boulevard at the bridge over the river. That was the big high school drive-in with the huge streamlined sculpted pastel display sign with streaming streamlined super slick A22 italic script, floodlights, clamp-on trays, car hop girls in floppy blue slacks, hamburgers in some kind of tissuey wax paper steaming with onions pressed down and fried on the grill and mustard and ketchup to squirt all over it from out plastic squirt cylinders. Saturday nights, when everybody is out cruising, some guy was in his car in the lot at Greg's going the wrong way so nobody could move. The more everybody blew the horns, the more determined the guy got. Like this was the test. He rolls up the windows and locks the doors so they can't get at him and keeps boring in. This guy versus Kesey. So Kesey goes inside and gets a potato they make the French fries with and comes out and jams it over the guy's exhaust pipe, which causes the motor to conk out and you ain't going any which way now, bub. The guy brings charges against Kesey for ruining his engine, and Kesey ends up in juvenile court before a judge and tries to tell him how it is at Greg's Drive-In on a Saturday night. The life, that feeling, the life, the late 1940s, early 1950s American teenage drive-in life was precisely what it was all about, but how could you tell anyone about it? But of course, the feeling, out here at night, free, with the motor running and the adrenaline flowing, cruising in the neon glories of the new American night. It was very heaven to be the first wave of the most extraordinary kids in the history of the world, only 15, 16, 17 years old, dressed in the haute couture of pink Oxford shirts, sharp pants, snaky half-inch belts, fast shoes, with all this straight six and V8 power underneath and all this neon glamour overhead, which somehow tied in with the technological superheroics of the jet, TV, atomic subs, ultrasonics, post-war American suburbs, glorious world, and the hell with the intellectual badmouthers of America's tailfin civilization. They couldn't know what it was like, or else they had it cultivated out of them, the feeling, to be very super kids, the world's first generation of the little devils, feeling immune beyond calamity. Once parents remembered the sloughing common order, war and depression. But super kids knew only the emotional surge of the great payoff when nothing was common any longer. The life. A glorious place, a glorious age, I tell you. A very neon renaissance. And the myths that actually touched you at that time, not Hercules, Orpheus, Ulysses, and Aeneas, but Superman, Captain Marvel, Batman, the Human Torch, the Submariner, Captain America, Plastic Man, the Flash, but of course, on Perry Lane, what did they think it was? Quaint when he talked about the comic book superheroes as the honest American myths? It was a fantasy world already, this electro-pastel world of Mom and Dad and Buddy and Sis in the suburbs. There they go in the family car, a white Pontiac Bonneville sedan. The family car, a huge, crazy, god-awful, powerful fantasy creature to begin with. 327 horsepower, shaped like 27 nights of lubricious luxury brome seduction. You're already there in Fantasyland, so why not move off your snug harbor quilty bed dead center and cut loose? Go ahead and say it. Shazam! Juice it up to what it's already aching to be. 327,000 horsepower, a whole superhighway long and soaring, screaming on toward Edge City and ultimate fantasies, current and future. Billy Batson said Shazam and turned into Captain Marvel. Jay Garrick inhaled an experimental gas in the research lab and began traveling and thinking at the speed of light as the Flash, the current fantasy. Yes, The Kesey Diamond in the Rough fantasy did not last very long. The most interesting person on Perry Lane, as far as he was concerned, was not any of the novelists or other literary intellectuals, but a young graduate student in psychology named Vic Lovell. Lovell was like a young Viennese analyst, or at least a California graduate school version of one. He was slender, with wild dark hair, and very cool intellectually, and wound up at the same time. He introduced Kesey to Freudian psychology. Kesey had never run into a system of thought like this before. Lovell could point out in the most persuasive way how mundane character traits and minor hassles around Perry Lane fit into the richest, most complex metaphor of life ever devised, namely Freud's. And a little experimental gas? Yes. Lovell told him about some experiments the Veterans Hospital in Menlo Park was running with psychomimetic drugs, drugs that brought on temporary states resembling psychoses. They were paying volunteers $75 a day. Kesey volunteered. It was all nicely calcimined and clinical. They would put him on a bed in a white room and give him a series of capsules without saying what they were. One would be nothing, a placebo. One would be Ditran, which always brought on a terrible experience. Kesey could always tell that one coming on because the hairs on the blanket he was under would suddenly look like a field of hideously diseased thorns, and he would put his finger down his throat and retch. But one of them, the first thing he knew about it, was a squirrel dropped an acorn from a tree outside, only it was tremendously loud and sounded like it was not outside but right in the room with him, and not actually a sound either, but a great suffusing presence, visual, almost tactile, a great impacting of blue all around him, and suddenly he was in a realm of consciousness he had never dreamed of before, and it was not a dream or a delirium but part of his awareness. He looks at the ceiling. It begins moving. Panic. And yet there is no panic. The ceiling is moving, not in a crazed swirl, but along its own planes of light and shadow and surface, not nearly so nice and smooth as Plasterer Super Plaster Man intended, with infallible carpenter-level bubble sliding and dim honey caro syrup tube. Not so foolproof as you thought, bub. Little lumps and ridges up there, bub. And lines. Lines like spines on crests of waves of white desert movie sand, each one with MGM shadow long shot of the ominous Arab coming up over the next crest, for only the sinister Saracen can see the road. And you didn't know how many subplots you left up there, Plaster Man, trying to smooth it all out, all of it, with your bubble in a honey tube carpenter's level, to make us all down here look up and see nothing but ceiling, because we all know ceiling, because it has a name, ceiling. Therefore it is nothing but a ceiling. No room for Arabs up there in level land, eh, Plaster Man? Suddenly he is like a ping-pong ball in a flood of sensory stimuli, heart beating, blood coursing, breath suspiring, teeth grating, hand moving over the percale sheet over those thousands of minute wharfy woofings like a brush fire, sun glow and the highlight on a stainless steel rod. Quite a little movie you have going on in that highlight there. Hondo, Technicolors. Pick each one out like fishing for neon gumballs with a steam shovel in the Funtime Arcade. A ping-pong ball in a flood of sensory stimuli, all quite ordinary, but revealing themselves for the first time and happening now, as if for the first time he has entered a moment in his life and known exactly what is happening to his senses now at this moment. And with each new discovery, it is as if he has entered into all of it himself, is one with it. The movie white desert of the ceiling becomes something rich, personal, his, beautiful beyond description, like an orgasm behind the eyeballs, and his Arabs, Arabs behind the eyelids, eyelid movies, room for them and a lot more in the 5 billion thoughts per second stroboscope synapses, his Arab heroes, fine daily double horsehair mustaches wrapped about the orbicularis oris of their mouths. Face, the doctor comes back in, and marvelous, poor, tight, cone-ass doc, Kesey can now see into him. For the first time he notices that the doctor's lower left lip is trembling. But he more than sees the tremor, he understands it. He can almost see each muscle fiber decussate, pulling the poor jelly of his lip to the left and the fibers one by one leading back into infrared caverns of the body. through transistor radio innards of nerve tangles, each one on red alert, the poor ninny's inner hooks desperately trying to make the little writhing bastards keep still in there. I am doctor. This is human specimen before me. The poor ninny has his own desert movie going on inside. Only each horsehair Arab is a threat. If only his lip, his face would stay level, level like the honey bubble of the official plaster man assured him it would. Miraculous. He could truly see into people for the first time, and yes, that little capsule sliding blissfully, blissfully down the gullet was LSD. Very soon it was already time to push on beyond another fantasy, the fantasy of the Menlo Park clinicians. The clinicians' fantasy was that the volunteers were laboratory animals that had to be dealt with objectively, quantitatively. It was well known that people who volunteered for drug experiments tended to be unstable anyway. So the doctors would come in white smocks with the clipboards, taking blood pressures and heart rates and urine specimens, and having them try to solve simple problems in logic and mathematics, such as adding up columns of figures and having them judge time and distances, although they did have them talk into tape recorders, too. But the doctors were so out of it. They never took LSD themselves, and they had absolutely no comprehension, and it couldn't be put into words anyway. Sometimes you wanted to paint it huge. Lovell is under LSD in the clinic, and he starts drawing a huge Buddha on the wall. It somehow encompasses the whole. White Smock comes in and doesn't even look at it. He just starts asking the old questions on the clipboard, so Lovell suddenly butts in. What do you think of my Buddha? White Smock looks at it a moment and says, It looks very feminine. Now let's see how rapidly you can add up this column of figures here. Very feminine. Deliver us from the clichés that have locked up even these so-called experimenters' brains like the accordion fences in the first-door window. And Kesey was having the same problem with his boys. One of them was a young guy with a lie-down crew cut and the straightest face, the straightest, blandest, most lineless, awfulest plasterman honey-bubble-levelest face ever made. And he would come in and open his eyes wide once, as if to make sure this muscular hulk on the bed were still rational, and then get this smug tone in his voice which poured out into the room like absorbent cotton choked in chalk dust from beaten erasers Springfield High School. Now, when I say go, you tell me when you think a minute is up by saying now. Have you got that? Yeah, he had that. Kesey was soaring on LSD, and his sense of time was wasted. And thousands of thoughts per second were wrapping around between synapses, fractions of a second. So what the hell is a minute? But then one thought stuck in there, held. Malicious. Delicious. He remembered that his pulse had been running 75 beats a minute every time they took it. So when Dr. Fogg says go, Kesey slyly slides his slithering finger onto his pulse and counts up to 75 and says, Now. Dr. Smog looks at his stopwatch. Amazing, he says, and walks out of the room. You said it, bub, but like a lot of other people, you don't even know. LSD. Now that those big fat letters are babbling out on coated stock from every newsstand. But this was late 1959, early 1960, a full 2 years before Mom and Dad and Buddy and Sis heard of the dread letters and clucked because Doctors Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert were French-frying the brains of Harvard boys with it. It was even before Dr. Humphrey Osmond had invented the term psychedelic, which was later amended to psychedelic to get rid of the nuthouse connotation of psycho. LSD, it was quite a little secret to have stumbled onto, a hulking super-secret, in fact, the triumph of the guinea pigs. In a short time, he and Lovell had tried the whole range of the drugs, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, peyote, IT-290, the superamphetamine, Ditran the bummer, morning glory seeds. They were on to a discovery that the Menlo Park clinicians themselves never, mighty fine irony here, the White Smocks were supposedly using them. Instead, the White Smocks had handed them the very key itself. And you don't even know, bub. With these drugs, your perception is altered enough that you find yourself looking out of completely strange eye holes. All of us have a great deal of our minds locked shut. We are shut off from our own world, and these drugs seem to be the key to open these locked doors. How many, maybe 2 dozen people in the world, were onto this incredible secret? One was Aldous Huxley, who had taken mescaline and written about it in The Doors of Perception. He compared the brain to a reducing valve. In ordinary perception, the senses send an overwhelming flood of information to the brain, which the brain then filters down to a trickle it can manage for the purpose of survival in a highly competitive world.